Please be seated. Well, good afternoon. I bet a lot of you would like to be out there in that sunshine. We get so little of it at this time of year.
Should we ask them to raise their hands if they want to be
there? Probably.
Just legal, put your hand down.
Probably not. My notes do show me that we have students from the Lake Mills High School who are with us today. If that's correct, would they and their advisors please stand? Oh, very good. Well, thank you. Please be seated. Did you have an opportunity to come in here, Justice Ziegler, before this argument?
I recognize them. They sure did.
Yeah, good. Well, that's great. The students are here with a program called Court with Class, and so they've had some opportunity to learn about the cases that the case that we're going to argue right now. Since we've seen you, or at least Justice Ziegler has probably seen more of you than the rest of us, I want to introduce the court to you. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, of course, Justice Ziegler, whom you may have met. Next to Justice Ziegler, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gabelman. And on the far end, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those brief remarks in place, are you prepared to begin? Please do.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Michelle Velasquez, and I am the attorney representing the defendant appellant petitioner Ernesto Lasso Villamil in this matter. The issue before this court today is whether or not Wisconsin Statute 343.44 sub 2 sub AR4 can be interpreted in a manner that resolves both the ambiguity and is constitutional. That statute provides that any one person who violates the base staff, the base offense, operating after revocation in violation of Wisconsin Statute 343.44 sub 1 sub B, and in the course of that violation causes the death of another person, shall be fined not less than $7,500, nor more than $10,000, or imprisoned for not more than 1 year in the county jail or both, except that if that person knows at the time of the violation that his or her operating privileges have been revoked, that person is then guilty of a Class H felony. By incorporation, in order for one to be guilty of 343.44 sub 2 sub AR 4, one must also be guilty of the underlying offense operating after revocation, which requires that no one person whose operating privileges have been revoked under the laws of the state may knowingly operate a motor vehicle upon a highway in the state during the period of revocation. That is the problem in this matter. The base offense already requires that a person have knowledge that his or her operating privileges have been revoked in order to be guilty of that base offense. Therefore, the additional penalty as provided for in sub 2 sub AR 4 is illusory. A person cannot knowingly know that their operating privileges have been revoked. The state agrees with the defendant in this matter that the language can be interpreted in both ways as being either a misdemeanor or a felony, and that it is therefore ambiguous.
Counsel, can you explain to me how this could be interpreted as a misdemeanor?
Yes. In its form at the time of the offense, which was in 2012, and the current state of the statute 343.44 sub 2 sub AR 4, says any one person who violates sub 1 sub B, which is the underlying offense of operating after revocation, and in the course of the violation causes the death of another, shall be fined not less than $7,500 nor more than $10,000. Or imprisoned for not more than 1 year in the county jail. It then goes on to provide that if a person knows their operating privileges have been revoked, they're guilty of a Class H felony.
Shouldn't we start with 1B?
Yes.
That's the definition of the offense, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay. And the definition of the offense contains a knowing element, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So that's the offense. The offense of operating while revoked requires that you know that you're doing it.
That's correct. The offense of operating after revocation requires that there's knowledge that the license has been revoked.
Okay. So now when you get down to paragraph 2, AR 4, how do you access the misdemeanor language?
The misdemeanor portion is contained in the first half of the penalty statute, which states that a person can be imprisoned for not more than 1 year in the county jail if they are in violation of sub 1 sub B, which it has been established requires knowledge, except for if that person knows at the time of violating of this violation that his or her privileges have been revoked.
All right. So let's look at that term except, and it appears to me, and see if you agree with this, that this creates a disjunctive set of choices. One, where there is a misdemeanor penalty, and one where there is a felony penalty, correct?
That's correct. There's two penalties under this statute.
All right. Now, if you get to the penalty part of the statute, it's only because you've already established that there's a knowing violation, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if there's a knowing violation and the penalty section says that a knowing violation is a felony, how do you get to the misdemeanor language? Because that would require something less than knowing, right?
We don't know that because the statute provides for both a misdemeanor and a felony because, as Your Honor has indicated, in order to get to the penalty section, one must have already known that their license was revoked.
Right. So we've got the knowing. We've got that figured out. So we know that by the time we get to penalty, we're only dealing with a person who knowingly drove while revoked. Right?
There are no other provisions in this statute that provide for it to be an offense under which a person operates after revocation but doesn't know that his or her license is revoked.
Right. So every single time that we get to the penalty phase or to the penalty question, we know that we're dealing with someone who knowingly operated after revocation.
Correct. Every person who violates this section of the statute must know that his or her license is revoked, whether it's a civil forfeiture, whether it is the next penalty, which is 1 year of imprisonment if the violation or if the license had been revoked due to operating with a controlled substance or while intoxicated. And then the next graduated penalty phase under sub 2, sub AR 4, which is whether or not a death has occurred as a result of operating after revocation.
Right. So if we follow that language in 2AR4, then we bump up against the except part, right? And it says, except if you do this knowingly, you're guilty of a felony. And so if we follow the language of the statute, given the facts at hand, then we must always end up in the felony part of that paragraph, right? Because it's knowing.
No, I don't believe that you always end up in the felony part. That's the problem in this case, is that subsection provides for both a misdemeanor, which by definition is imprisonment of a year or less, or a Class H felony. I understand that the language is except if at the time the person knows, but in order to even arrive at the penalty section, the person must have already known that his or her license has been revoked.
Right. So what that tells us is that by the time we get to the penalty paragraph, we know where we're going to end up because we're only ever going to be dealing with people who are knowingly operating after revocation.
It's correct that every person who arrives at the penalty section, again, whether it's a forfeiture or something more, must know that his or her license has been revoked. But arriving at the penalty section under this subsection doesn't necessarily require a felony. And again, that's the issue in this case, is that this subsection is a result of poor legislative drafting. The legislative history in this...
Wait, before you go to the legislative history, I want to stop on why that except and the clause that follows does not require a finding of a felony. Because it says, except that if the person knows at the time of the violation that his or her operating privilege has been revoked, the person is guilty of a Class H felony. That's declarative, right?
A person is also, however, guilty because, again, as the statute states, any person who violates subsection 1, Sub B, and in the course of that violation causes the death of another, shall be fined not less than $7,500 nor more than $10,000 or imprisoned for a year. So they have already violated sub 1, sub B, which requires knowledge.
Right. So sub 1, sub B is the definition of the offense. 2, AR4 is the definition of the penalty. And from that, we have to choose what penalty is going to be appropriate for the violation that we know has occurred. And that tells us that if you do it knowingly, you are guilty of a felony. How do you get to the misdemeanor language if the language says you're guilty of a felony if you do it knowingly?
But the language also says that you're guilty of a misdemeanor if you violate sub 1 sub B. And I believe that the state is in agreement with that interpretation.
Except there's the accept part.
However, that's illusory, because knowledge is already required for the base offense.
Why is that illusory as opposed to redundant?
Because there can't be knowingly knowing that their license has been revoked. It would be analogous to charging someone for armed robbery with use of a dangerous weapon. That's two penalty enhancers. There has to be a separate... An element that increases the penalty has to be something that's not already contained in that base offense.
Why is this a penalty enhancer as opposed to simply selecting which penalty is going to apply?
This is a penalty enhancer because the base offense is required before the penalty increases, whether, again, it increases because of the cause of the license being revoked or it increases because of any harm or the type of harm being created as a result of driving after revocation.
Well, this isn't increasing the penalty. You get one penalty or the other.
However, the legislature didn't intend for there to be a choice between two different penalties for prosecutors to be able to choose between either the first penalty described in sub 2 sub AR4 or the Class H penalty. There was an intention, I believe, based on the legislative history, to make a graduated penalty scheme. However, they failed to effectuate that and instead, without intention, created two identical statutes with vastly different penalties.
Maybe their intent is what the state says at one point in one of its briefs, that the intent was to, and I think maybe this is what the statute can be interpreted as, saying this legislature intended to do away with the misdemeanor and only deal with it. This is a felony. They just screwed up. That's a technical legal term.
The legislative history certainly suggests that there was an intention to repeal the element of knowledge from that base offense under sub 1 sub B. The legislative history also shows an intent to have the penalties described in sub 2 sub AR to mirror those described in sub 2 sub AG, which are the penalties prescribed for operating while suspended. However, neither of those actually came to fruition in the final draft of this statute.
But doesn't the Legislative Reference Bureau's analysis indicate that was their intent?
To repeal the element of knowledge in the base offense?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. However, the state's proposed fix for this problem, I believe, leads to other constitutional issues, namely notice. The statute as written provides for an element of knowledge. The statute above this one is operating while suspended, which does not have an element of knowledge and, in fact, explicitly states knowledge is not an element of this offense. An ordinary person reading those statutes would have absolutely no notice that knowledge is to be read out of that base offense, and therefore doing what the state proposes would create a strict liability offense.
Why even take up this implied repeal argument? Look, you talk about the ordinary person. The ordinary person reading these two provisions would say you need knowledge. The difference is one is a misdemeanor, the other is a felony. But both need knowledge. So what's wrong with that? We have other situations. You can have
disorderly conduct. You can have an ordinance disorderly conduct, or you can have misdemeanor disorderly conduct. It's a matter of prosecutorial discretion. What do you want? You know, pick one. Pick one, DA. You can have a marijuana offense. It can be an ordinance violation, or it can be, I'll use an example of ordinance violation. A corollary would be a statutory misdemeanor. What's wrong with, look, I know what the legislative history is. Looks like there was a little mix-up here. But if you're talking about the ordinary person and notice coming and reading these, they would say both have knowledge. The difference is different penalty, and it's the not the dealer's choice, but the DA's choice. What's wrong with that?
I think there are a couple of things that would be wrong with that interpretation. First, to interpret this as two different offenses, or I'm sorry, one identical offense that has two different penalties would be contrary to what the legislative intent was in the first place, which was
why,
to create.
Why not just stay with the plain language of the statutes? Why go to the legislative intent?
I think there are other issues in interpreting the statute to be both a misdemeanor and a felony. First, it gives prosecutorial discretion where none was intended. Second, I think there are constitutional issues around identical statutes in relation specifically to due process and equal protection. This court decided about 30-something years ago in State v. Sissel that identical statutes were okay following the reasoning of United States versus Batchelder, which held as such in analyzing overlapping statutes. However, in this case, we have no intent on the part of the legislature to create identical statutes. Equal protection is not simply about preventing discriminatory prosecution on the basis of race, class, gender, or religion, but it's also about a rational basis for the act itself or the statute itself. And here, there is no rational basis for enacting a statute that is identical that creates two different penalties.
A DA's discretion, that's a rational basis. I mean, I'm not so interested what the legislature intended. I guess I'm interested in seeing what the legislature did, right? Read both, plain language, need knowingly. Now, maybe that's a constitutional violation, so persuade me it's a constitutional violation. But if both plain language gives discretion to the DA, what's wrong with that? Especially in view of Sissel.
This court certainly has the authority and the obligation to interpret statutes and to give effect to the meaning of a statute. However, this court has to do so first in line with the legislative intent. I don't think that legislative intent can be entirely cast aside in this case, because it was clear that they did not intend to give prosecutors discretion.
Well, what it looks like they intended to do is make an unknowing OAR a strict liability misdemeanor.
Right? I agree.
That's what the legislative history suggests.
I agree that the legislative history suggests that was the intent, was to create some kind of a strict liability offense for operating after revocation.
So
however,
the legislature
failed in giving effect to that.
It certainly did. But if you want us to construe this statute in accord with whatever the legislative intent is supposed to be, how does that help your client? Because your client knew that he was operating after revocation.
Correct. I think that my client is helped if this court decides that the statute cannot be fixed, essentially, that the fix that the Court of Appeals gave to it, which was to take the statute at its plain language and read it as either a misdemeanor or a felony violation, if this court decides that that's contrary to the legislative intent, that would be essentially legislating from the bench, which violates the separation of powers, or if this court decides that that is unconstitutional to have two identical statutes for which there is no rational basis to have two identical statutes and give DAs sort of this unfettered discretion, no, without any guidance whatsoever in this case. If this court decides that this mistake, essentially, by the legislator cannot be fixed, my client is helped because then I think he would be guilty of just the misdemeanor offense.
Why would he be guilty of just the misdemeanor offense? Why couldn't we say, well, look, there appears to be two potential punishments for this, one a misdemeanor, one a felony. Clearly, the 2AR4 says that if you do it knowingly, it's a felony. Why isn't the remedy to simply say, well, we don't know what to do with the misdemeanor language, but certainly we know that the statute actually says if you knowingly OAR, it's a felony, and we'll just apply that language.
Again, I don't think that you can just ignore the misdemeanor language in there. I think that under the rule of lenity, if this court cannot resolve the ambiguity and the statute is void, my client has to be convicted of the misdemeanor and not the felony.
Well, that would require a reading of the statute that enables us to get to the misdemeanor language when the actual language tells us that if it's knowing, we're always going to end up in the felony side.
I disagree with the reading that implies that that one will always end up at the felony for knowingly committing an OAR.
Right. So how would you get to the misdemeanor language if the language, as it does here, says that a knowing violation is a felony, right? By definition, you do it knowingly, it's a felony. How do you get to the misdemeanor language?
By definition, you get to the misdemeanor because you have violated sub 1, sub b, and in the course of that violation have caused the death of another.
Right. We're reading paragraph 2AR4, reading along, and it's talking about forfeiture, it's talking about misdemeanor, and we're thinking, okay, so far it looks like you got a forfeiture, a misdemeanor. Okay, we keep reading it, says accept that. And we go, oh, well, wait a minute. So maybe this language doesn't apply because it says accept that. And then we find out that if it's knowing, it's a felony. And so we go, oh, well, the prior language does not apply because the accept part says we're now in felony land.
Except that the first part of that statute also says that it's a misdemeanor. And I think what Your Honor is describing is the problem with this statute, in that how will a district attorney be able to exercise any discretion whatsoever? The exercise of discretion doesn't simply mean to make a decision. This exercise of discretion implies some kind of reasoning. And there's no guidance in that subsection to provide DAs with any guidance for how he or she should reason and determine whether or not a person should be charged under the statute as a misdemeanor or as a felony.
But when you have the accept that language, doesn't that tell you that you use the language that comes after instead of the language that comes before?
Except that the language that comes after is no different than the language that comes before.
Well, it is different. It says it's a felony.
But the reason for it becoming a felony is already encompassed in the first part of that statute.
So the legislature chewed its cabbage twice. What's the problem with that?
I'm sorry, I could not hear you.
So the legislature chewed its cabbage twice. What's the problem with that?
Heartburn. Apart from them being
inconsistent. It's redundant. Right. It says the same thing twice, but so what?
But they're inconsistent with one another, and again, there's no guidance for DAs.
If we accept your position, would we have to overrule CISL?
I don't think that this court would have to completely overrule CISL. There is a case from the Utah Supreme Court that is cited in my brief where that court dealt with sort of a similar issue in trying to reconcile a previous state case that said it was unconstitutional for there to be two identical statutes, but then also had later on adopted the reasoning of United States versus Batchelder. And what that court did was go beyond the plain language of the statute and look at the legislative intent to see whether or not there was a rational basis for adopting two identical statutes. In that case, the court was examining drug possession and possession of drug paraphernalia, and ultimately determined that there was a rational basis for the legislature to have adopted overlapping or identical statutes. In this case, I think the court can carve out an exception and say, to say when there are identical statutes, perhaps there is not a per se constitutional violation. However, it is highly suspect to have two identical statutes, I think, and it could potentially, as in this case, be the result of poor legislative drafting. And I think where that occurs, or where this court determines there's no rational basis for two identical statutes, then that those statutes have to be unconstitutional. I think that doesn't require a complete overruling of CISL, but I think that it does add a layer of analysis that would be required in that it should not be a per se rule that overlapping statutes and identical statutes are always pass muster under the Constitution because we give prosecutors discretion to choose.
But couldn't we infer a rational basis here by saying that perhaps what the legislature intended, despite, I admit, legislative history to the contrary, they intended to give the prosecutor that discretion to charge as a misdemeanor or a felony by looking at mitigating and aggravating circumstances, for example?
If a statute such as this one outlined some of the mitigating and aggravating circumstances to provide guidance for prosecutors when determining whether or not to prosecute this as a misdemeanor or a felony, that would be okay. There would be a rational basis, and there would also be guidance provided to the prosecutors, which is the role of the legislature is to provide guidance as to how to enforce the statutes. Without any guidance, and moreover with, I think, legislative history that clearly shows there was never an intent to create two identical statutes, there can be no rational basis here for a reading of the statute that allows for either a misdemeanor or felony prosecution.
Give me your best argument why shall means shall.
Is Your Honor referring to the sentencing?
I'm referring to 343.44.2b.
Sure.
And that is, should it be construed directory rather than mandatory, that issue?
Yes, this court assumes that the legislature chooses its words and does so with an intention to give effect to them. Here they chose the word shall to refer to guidelines to be, I see that my time is up, may I finish?
Yes, please.
Here they chose the word shall to refer to the sentencing guidelines that a court must follow. There are similar cases in which the courts have found that in an OWI, the guidelines were discretionary rather than mandatory, but those statutes don't contain the word shall in direct reference to guidelines and to factors that are then enumerated in the statute. And I think that because the legislature not only directed courts who are sentencing in these cases to guidelines, but also to specific enumerated factors, that shows an intent for courts to use those guidelines and factors when sentencing.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court. A number of the questions that this court has asked in this oral argument relate to the question of whether or not a statute that the legislature plainly never intended to create would be constitutional if the legislature had intended to create it.
I think it's a different issue than that. I think the issue is whether this court can take the word knowledge out of the definition section and in so doing create a new statute when our case law holds that only the legislature can create new crimes. And wouldn't we be creating a new crime
by taking that word
out and creating strict liability for the violation?
If you took that word out, which the legislature plainly intended to
take. I don't care what they intended, Counselor. I care about what they did, just so we're square on what we're talking about.
Okay. I know what they did. What they did was not what they intended to do. This court has constitutional authority to effectuate the clear intent of the legislature and where the clear intent of the legislature is to write a statute that does not contain the word knowingly, this court has constitutional authority to give effect to the intent of the legislature by interpreting a statute the way the legislature intended to write it.
And create a crime which currently isn't on the books, right?
Wrong.
It's not on the books today.
Well,
it depends. If we interpret it the way you're asking, it'll be on the books when our decision comes out, but it's not on the books today.
Well, it's not written on the books today. Let's put it that way. I think we can both agree on that, that
it's
not written in the books today,
Counselor.
The question of whether it is in the books today is what we're here to decide. And it is in the books if that's what the legislature, in fact, intended, but didn't actually write it in the books because of a drafting error. Somebody did bad proofing here. That's what happened. Somebody didn't proof this
Counselor,
the way they should have proofed it.
Counselor, can you today prosecute someone for an unknowing OAR?
I'm sorry?
Can you prosecute someone today for an unknowing OAR?
I absolutely believe that you can, but you'd have to engage in a statutory construction analysis in order to do that.
Could you do that before 2011?
Before 2011? No.
Okay.
No. Before 2011, it was absolutely clear that we had three offenses. We had operating without a license, operating while suspended, operating after revocation. All three of them were scienter offenses. All three of them required knowledge.
So at that point, we would expect an average citizen of the state to look at the statute and see knowing there and understand that knowing means knowing. Right?
No. No is the answer.
No. Prior to 2011.
Oh, prior to 2011. Yes.
So we expect a citizen reading that statute to come across that and says, "Oh, knowing. So I must know that my license is revoked for me to commit this crime." Right?
That would be correct. Prior to 2011.
2011 comes along. The legislature fails to remove the word. The average Wisconsin citizen comes along, same statute, looks at it and says, knowing. Oh, that means that I must knowingly drive on a revoked license. How is he supposed to know the difference between 2010 and 2011?
Okay. The thing is that in terms of an ambiguous statute.
Don't go there yet. I want to know. You said that you could prosecute an OAR today, unknown, because a citizen's got notice that unknowing OAR is a crime. So I want to know how he learned that in 2011.
Because what you have to do is when you want to interpret a statute, when you want to know what a statute prescribes, you have to look beyond the specific words of a statute. You can't say, oh, knowingly is in there, so it must mean knowingly. You have to look at the context of the statute, what the whole statute provides. You have to look at it in the context of other related statutes that deal with this. And when you do that, you come up with some real questions about whether knowingly really is an element of the base offense.
Right. And the way that we are trying to figure out what this statute should be applied is, as has been suggested, we go to legislative history. Are we expecting Wisconsin citizens to go to legislative history so they can understand what our statutes say?
It's not just when we're talking about an ambiguous statute, it's not just in the context of the average Wisconsin citizen. The case law plainly says it's a reasonably well-informed Wisconsin citizen.
I think that's the
not
average,
just, not just
that's
the average the, citizen.
I think
and
that's
you're
the
not
average
reasonably
Wisconsin
well-informed
citizen.
If you just look at one little part of a statute and say, oh, I know what this statute means. I've read this sentence. And, I mean, it's a page-long statute. It's lengthy. There's a lot of provisions in it. And you can't say a reasonably well-informed person would not say, oh, I know what this statute means because I've read this sentence. No, you have to read the whole statute, and you have to read the context of the statute, and you have to read it in the context of not just operating after revocation, but also operating while suspended
without a license. All right, so let's stop there for a minute. We'll put OWS to the side. So the reasonably well-informed Wisconsin citizen, I think that's the average Wisconsin citizen, by the way, he looks at this in 2010, and it says knowing once, and he knows by that that an OAR is criminal only if it's done knowing. In 2011, he looks at the statute, and he sees knowing twice, and by that, he's supposed to deduce that it means unknowing. How does that work?
I think what he's concerned with, and what I'm concerned with too, Counselor, is reading this word out of the statute, what kind of notice does that give to the people who try to comply with the laws? So you got knowing in there, and as Justice Kelly points out, in prior to 2011, he would know that if he's driving after revocation, he's violating the law. But now we're saying he can not know that he's been revoked or thought his revocation was done or something. And because we've taken the word knowing out of the statute by judicial interpretation, what notice does he have that he's violating the law?
Okay. Now, the question of notice does not, the constitutional due process requirement of notice does not require that a statute must not, there can't be any question about what the statute says. The requirement of notice is only that it gives the average citizen notice, if you read the whole statute, not just one sentence, not just one word, if you read the whole statute, it gives you notice that your conduct comes close to what is prohibited, that it may be prohibited. And that's where we get to the question of ambiguity here, because there are two possible readings of this statute. Reasonably well-informed people, by looking at this statute as a whole, in context, and we don't even get to the legislative history. We don't even have to get to the legislative history here. So all we have to do is look at this statute, and it raises some real questions. Did the legislature really intend to differentiate between operating without a license, operating while suspended, operating after revocation, and make one of these offenses a knowing offense?
You are a fine lawyer. Before I went to law school, I did research in hematology and physiology. Okay, I had a college degree, and I worked in medical schools and various universities. Before I went to law school, I wouldn't have had a clue to do what you're suggesting. Not a clue. Not a clue.
You wouldn't have found that this statute creates some real questions?
No, I would think that if I had been revoked and I thought my term was up and I'm driving my car, I wouldn't think I would violate the statute. I mean, I would read it knowing, well, shoot, if I did it, gosh, officer, I'm really sorry. I thought my revocation was done 3 weeks ago and I was okay. I would just never, I wouldn't have a clue. I'm sorry.
And scienter is kind of an important thing when it comes to a criminal statute, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Scienter is kind of an important thing, mens rea, when we're talking about a criminal statute.
That is.
It's kind of important. And for the state to suggest that knowing means unknowing.
I'm not suggesting that. No. I've never suggested that knowing means unknowing. I know knowing means knowing.
Right.
And I don't suggest otherwise.
I'm putting myself in the position of a reasonably well-informed Wisconsin citizen. I'm looking at the statute, and it says knowing, and I'm supposed to understand by that that what it really means is unknowing.
I think what you're supposed to do, I think what a reasonably well-informed person would do is to say there are some real questions here about whether this statute really requires knowledge as an element.
And I was supposed to come to that conclusion because the statute says knowing not once, but twice. And by the fact that it says it twice, I'm supposed to suspect that it means not knowing.
There are several reasons why it I want to say it a little differently than what you said.
Sure you do.
But there are several reasons why a person reading this statute could reasonably suspect, that knowledge was really not intended as an element of the base offense. One is that if knowledge is an element of the base offense, then knowledge is also an element of the first penalty enhancer. Because for the first penalty enhancer to apply, you have to operate a vehicle, you have to have your license revoked, and you have to know that it's revoked, and then you have to kill someone. That's when the first penalty enhancer kicks in. But that's exactly what happens when the second penalty enhancer kicks in. The same elements, exactly, for both penalty enhancers. And a reasonable person could say, well, did the legislature really intend to do that? They could do that if they wanted to, but that's kind of a bizarre situation. That's not the way they usually work. The way they usually work is the way they worked with the operating while suspended. You commit a base offense, no scienter, strict liability, the first penalty enhancer, no knowledge, strict liability, the third penalty enhancer, which goes up from a misdemeanor to a felony, and that's a pretty big jump, knowledge is required. They could say, wait a minute, if they intended that with respect to operating while suspended, isn't it likely that they also intended that for operating after revocation? Why in the world would they create a statute with slightly different wording in the two penalty enhancers, but regardless of that slightly different wording, you still have exactly the same elements? Why would they do that? Why does that make sense?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's what brought it to this court, which suggests that it requires a level of knowledge beyond that of the reasonably well-informed Wisconsin citizen.
A reasonably informed citizen would have that question. What did they intend? Did they actually intend to create two penalty enhancers having exactly the same elements but two different penalties? That doesn't make a whole lot of
sense.
Whatever
they intended, can they do it? Are you going to defend that they can have a misdemeanor and a felony, both having the same elements, and that the choice is for the prosecutor? That's the issue I want you to answer, and that you should say that, yes, that comes under CISL, no, or Karpinski, and that what is, and Batchelder. What's your position on that? I don't want to know about what the legislature might have intended. We always say they said what they mean what they said.
They didn't say what they mean and meant what they said here. That is pretty clear.
I want you to tell me, is it constitutional?
Sure, it's constitutional.
Okay.
They could do it.
Why don't you just say that? What's constitutional, and this court can't do anything about it. That's it.
What's your best argument?
I agree with you, sure.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm agreeing with Justice Abrahamson. I think that's a very important question. It's not where you want to go, but give us your best argument about why they could make two penalties for essentially the same conduct.
Why they could?
I disagree with you on that, and I wrote that in the dissent in CISL, and I did it under the state law rather than under the federal law. But that isn't what CISL said. Now, CISL was overlapping statutes, not exactly the same statute, but I don't know that that matters. And
well, CISL specifically says it doesn't.
That's right. So why don't you just stand up there and say, this is the law, go to it.
Why am I not doing it? I am not doing it because that's not what the legislature intended me to do. It's the simple answer. I mean, I could stand up and say, and that's what I started out saying. I could stand up here and say, yes, we have a statute that the legislature never intended to create. Yes, they set up a statutory scheme that they could have created, would be constitutional.
When did the legislature do this? What year? 2011?
Yeah.
2011.
2011, yeah.
Now 2017. Did the State Department of Justice ever go to the legislature and say, whoops, the legislative analysis here is that it shouldn't be two exact same statutes? If you read the analysis but didn't read the statute carefully, you enacted the wrong statute. There's a goof. You ought to change this. Has anyone ever done that?
Not to my knowledge.
That's right.
No, we've never done that. And the reason we've never done it is because it's never been an issue until this case.
It's on the face of the statute an issue. Even you have to say it's on the face of the statute an issue, but you want the statute interpreted not to say what it says, not to mean what it says, because that isn't what they intended. That's a summation of your argument. Is that unfair?
No, what I'm saying is what's on the face of the statute is not what they intended to have on the face of the statute.
That's right. That's what you are saying. The Court of Appeals approached it differently, and you have an approach that's not in accord with the Court of Appeals.
Exactly. That's why I petitioned for cross-review.
That's right. I understand the Court of Appeals to say, okay, defendant, your first argument is one of lenity. The rule of lenity is a two-part test which requires us to take a look in the second part of the test what the legislative intent is. So for purposes of the argument of the rule of lenity only, they said, we're going to take a look at the intent, because that's the part, that's the test. And so rule of lenity is inapplicable. Then they went on in paragraph 13 to say, okay, now we're going to look at the statute, and we're going to hold the legislature to what they said. And they do that, and they also say, look, the defendant here was convicted of the H felony. That's what he says. There's no problem with notice. The only problem here is the failure of the court to consider what's set forth in the statute when it is mandatory reverse and remand for resentencing. What's wrong with that analysis, if I've accurately summarized?
What's wrong with that analysis is that it does not give effect to the true intent of the legislature.
You know, it's
a decision that deals with essentially a hypothetical legislative question. What if the legislature had intended to create a statute that provided for two completely different penalties for exactly the same conduct? What if they had intended to do that? If they had intended to do that, would that be constitutional? Why? Yeah, we think so. If they had intended to do that, we'd say it was constitutional.
What's your best argument, Counselor, for saying that two penalties for the same conduct without specific guidance to the prosecutor about which penalty to seek is constitutional? What's your best argument? I don't know you don't like that argument, but perhaps some of us do like it. We'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay. My best argument for why it would be constitutional if the legislature had intended to do that, and I emphasize if, but if the legislature had intended to do that, it would be constitutional because a legislature could rationally decide that there were different levels of culpability here that could be treated differently in the discretion of the prosecutor. As I spelled out in my argument, the statute requires that for the penalty enhancers to apply, the defendant has to cause the death of a person. Now, causation is kind of a, you know, slippery concept. It can be any factor, any fact, any act on the part of the defendant that plays any part in causing the death. It can be either extremely egregious, culpable conduct, extremely reckless conduct, or it can be just marginally negligent conduct. And the legislature could, in its discretion, decide that the prosecutor should have discretion to charge the misdemeanor in those cases where the causation was just marginally, ordinarily negligent conduct, but charge the felony in those situations where it was egregious, reckless conduct. That is a rational basis. That would be a rational basis for creating a statute that had both a misdemeanor enhancer and a felony enhancer for exactly the same conduct.
Thank you.
That's my best argument for why such a statute would be constitutional if the legislature had intended to enact it.
You'd rely on Batchelder.
I'm sorry?
You'd rely on the federal case, Batchelder.
And Sissel.
And Sissel. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Counsel, is it possible that after the legislature failed to have this proper statute launch, that they looked back at it some later time and said, "Yeah, we just don't care. We'll just leave it the way it is. We changed our mind. We don't want a strict liability OAO." Possible?
Theoretically, that would be possible, yeah.
Okay. Given that theoretical possibility, do you think it would be appropriate for us to assume that that was not now what they intended, given that they've had 6 years to change this?
Yes. I don't think you can make that assumption. In light of the... I have handled numerous statutory construction cases over the 45 years I've been doing this. I have never had one like this. I have never had a statutory construction case where it was just so plainly obvious. It was absolutely unequivocal what the legislature intended, and so unequivocal and plainly obvious that they screwed up by failing to delete one single word out of the statute. Never had one like
that. And if it's that plainly and unequivocally obvious that the statute ought to be construed as a strict liability offense, such that it would be due notice to the people of Wisconsin that it is strict liability, has anyone, to your knowledge, in the last 6 years prosecuted anyone for an unknowing OAR?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Why is that, do you think?
I'm sorry?
Why is that, do you think?
Because I think that in most cases people know they're revoked, and there's never really any question about it. How do you not know that you're revoked? Especially in a case like this where you're revoked because you've been convicted of drunk driving. How do you not know that you're revoked? I mean, I think in 99.9% of the cases, and I used to prosecute these back years ago when I was a trial-level prosecutor back in Milwaukee, there was never a question about knowledge. You knew you were revoked.
And in those cases where there was question about whether there is knowledge, might it not be that there have been no prosecutions for an unknowing OAR because the district attorneys of the state looked at the statute and they saw knowing?
I mean, I can't speak to those hypotheticals. It's possible. I can't say yes, I can't say no. But we have a problem in this case.
What about cases that have been pending or that you know about? Are there some that the prosecutors have used the misdemeanor and others where they use the felony?
I'm not aware of, and I really don't have much of a way of becoming aware of situations where there's been a prosecution.
Happening around the state.
I'm sorry?
You don't know what's happening around the state.
I have no way of knowing that.
The DAs are using the felony or using the misdemeanor. You don't know that.
Unless somebody appeals, as Mr. Laza Villamil did, I would not know that.
Don't keep count? Your office doesn't have any statistics on this? You didn't ask.
I didn't ask the Office of Justice Assistance.
Just curious.
Okay, I would like to address my second argument.
Yep, I was going to ask you about that sentencing here.
Yes. On the sentencing issue, this I do know. This I do know from talking to people who do prosecute these offenses. No judge actually considers these aggravating factors in sentencing for OAR. It's just not done.
When you say don't consider, you mean on the record. They
don't on the
touch
record.
Each of these
bases. They don't do what you have suggested that they should do, and that is to say, I've considered these offenses. I've considered these factors.
All of these considerations, and on the basis of my consideration, I want the following sentence.
Right.
Imposed.
They don't do that. That is not a practice that they ordinarily engage in.
What does the judicial handbook say about that?
That I'm not aware of either. I just know they don't do it.
Okay. On the basis of you're talking to prosecutors, they don't
right.
do that.
And expanding this, and expanding this. We also have a general sentencing statute in Chapter 973 that also says that the court shall consider certain factors in imposing a sentence. I have never seen a sentencing transcript, ever, not one, where a court considered those factors in imposing a sentence. Not one sentencing transcript. Judges just don't do it.
Why don't judges obey the law?
Because there's a question. Because there's a question about whether they have to obey the law. There's a genuine question. I know. I understand. I understand that the statute uses the word shall. But the word shall is inherently ambiguous because it can mean either of two things. It can
either. In this statute, the word shall and may are both used, and the court says when they're both used, they obviously were used for different meanings.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe.
So you want to not only reinterpret the elements of this offense, you now want to reinterpret what the sentencing means.
I think you have to interpret the sentencing statute. And what I'm trying to say here is that nobody, no judge who actually does sentencing interprets these statutes, although they say shall, to be mandatory.
So counsel,
what they do is they go through the sentencing factors that they believe are relevant to a case, whether they're the statutorily enumerated factors or not. They go through the factors that are that they think are relevant to that particular sentence, and they impose a sentence based on those factors, not the factors that the legislature says they have to.
So, counsel,
sure, you're quite right on that, Counselor, because under Section 973, there are three factors that are mandatory for the courts to mention on the record: protection of the public, gravity of the offense, rehabilitative needs of the defendant. And then the court is also mandated to consider and mention on the record any applicable mitigating or aggravating factors.
Right.
So they don't have to mention all of them. That's where the discretion comes in. But there are mandatory ones, and I think every court does indeed address the mandatory
the first three?
Factors.
The first three that you're talking
yes.
about?
The gravity
but
of
those
the
aren't just statutory. Those aren't just statutorily
the
mandated factors. Those are factors that this court has mandated going way back when.
That's correct, because the language in the statute and the language in Galleon mandates it. So that's where I'm struggling with your argument, because regardless of whether the courts are or are not following the statute, in my
mind, just talking
shall
about,
means must here.
No, I'm just talking about those specific aggravating factors. I'm not talking about the three general factors that the court has to consider, because my point here is that even apart from the statute just codifies what the rules of this court regarding sentencing discretion, the rules that have applied for years and years and years, that, you know, you have to consider these three factors. That's just a codification of case law. What I'm talking about is these very specific factors that are listed in the statutes. That's what the courts are not considering. That's what the courts are not stating on the record that they have considered, because they're interpreting that, they're interpreting these statutes, despite the fact that they say shall, they're interpreting these statutes to be directory. And there's some basis for that.
So, counsel, what language would the legislature need to use to get them to actually address all of those factors?
Well, they can use very clear language like must, the court is required to consider, you know, that kind of language. I have a problem when the court uses shall, because it is ambiguous. It can be directory, it can be just discretionary. It can be either one. And the legislature always creates a problem when it uses shall rather than other language that can't be interpreted two ways. When you say you're required to do this, you must do this, you have no choice but to do this, that's clear.
But isn't it clear in context?
I'm sorry?
Isn't it clear in context? You're asking us to interpret the other portion of the statute in context in relation to it.
Well, I don't think it's clear in the context. I think there's a real question in the context about when you actually look at some of these factors, some of them are strange. I mean, like in the operating after revocation statute, you're supposed to consider the class of the vehicle. How does that relate? In a base operating after revocation offense, how does the class of the vehicle, and class is based, by the way, ordinarily on the weight of the vehicle, what difference does it make if I'm sentencing someone for operating after revocation, whether the guy is operating a Mini Cooper or a dump truck? What difference does that make? And yet the statute says, I shall consider that. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't.
Well,
there's a lot of things about this statute that don't make sense if you consider them mandatory. That's why there's a problem. And in order to make it rational, it needs to be interpreted as directory. Thank you. My time is up. I appreciate your paying attention to my argument. Thank you.
Counselor, what's your best argument why it's unconstitutional for the legislature to have created the two statutes that are in the books?
I think to create a statute that is identical with two separate penalties is unconstitutional for a couple of reasons. First, a person isn't put on notice as to how he or she may be prosecuted and why. There are no guidelines given to prosecutors. That is clearly the role of the legislature, to enact statutes that give guidance to both this court and the people enforcing the laws in the district attorney's offices around this state as to what conduct constitutes the offense, and then to courts as to under what circumstances a person should be punished accordingly under that statute. Here there just isn't that guidance.
Didn't your client, however, since it's uncontested that he knew and he was prosecuted with the enhancement of the felony, H-felony, doesn't that notice requirement become a bit irrelevant given that he was charged, what he was charged with and the penalty that he received?
However, he's not on notice as to what in particular about his conduct constituted the felony. His conduct, as it is in the record, could have constituted the misdemeanor offense as well. The state suggested that there were perhaps different levels of culpability and that a prosecutor could decide. And because prosecutors have discretion, a reading of the statute in this case where it's either a misdemeanor or a felony is constitutional. For example, the state suggested perhaps the conduct was extremely reckless or particularly negligent. However, the facts in this record don't suggest either of those. The defendant in this case was not cited for reckless or negligent driving in this case. So under the state's theory, perhaps he would have been convicted of the misdemeanor rather than the felony. Moreover, in the record, record site 49, which is the motion, the post-conviction motion hearing, I believe it's the post-conviction motion hearing, the prosecutor in this case stated that he didn't think anybody would ever charge the misdemeanor. I think that shows that on the face of the statute, the prosecutors perhaps are unsure or unclear as to whether or not they can charge this as a misdemeanor and under what circumstances. Certainly a blanket rule of never charging this as a misdemeanor doesn't show any kind of discretion whatsoever because there's no reasoning. It's just a decision being made, which is, again, no exercise of discretion.
Excuse me, just to redirect you, that is, the question was on what makes it unconstitutional. So now we have notice. Anything else that you're...
Yes, equal protection. Certainly. Again, equal protection isn't just whether or not someone has been discriminated against on the basis of their race, religion, sex, or gender, or any of the other qualifying classes, but also that there has to be a rational basis for the statute. And in this case, there is no rational basis to have enacted two identical statutes with vastly different penalties. I noticed this court is interested in the language of the statute and perhaps not going always to the legislative intent to talk about the proposal from the state and how to remedy this issue, but I think legislative intent is important when doing the constitutional analysis because, as I discussed previously, the State versus Williams out of Utah case went to the legislative intent to determine whether or not identical statutes could coexist in a constitutional way. And that court in that particular case, under those circumstances, determined that, yes, they could. Here we have a very different problem. We have legislative history that shows no intention from the legislature to create these two separate offenses. And certainly there's no guidance being given to prosecutors as to how and under what circumstances to charge. That is the role of the legislature in this case.
Well, Lefebvre, are you familiar with the Lefebvre
yes.
text I think you cited, takes the position that you look at United States v. Batchelder in that there are three kinds of offenses that can merge, and so you have felony and misdemeanor, and Lefebvre puts this one of exactly duplicative statutes in the position that Batchelder doesn't apply, where the statutes are identical, but the penalty is not, and he says that it's likely to be a consequence of legislative carelessness, which is in effect what the state is saying here, and that his position is it doesn't serve any legitimate purpose. There's nothing rational about a scheme that provides two different penalties for the same act, and if it doesn't provide assistance to the prosecutor in determining how to exercise discretion, confers totally unfettered discretion to the executive branch of government. That's what his position is, and that it's an equal protection argument. So, is that your position?
My red light is on, if I may just
you
answer,
can
that
answer
question.
The question.
Yes, that is absolutely the position of the defendant in this case. The situation that we have in this case is precisely what is described in Lefebvre. There's just simply no rational basis for the enactment of two identical statutes with different penalties, with no guidance to the legislature. And because there is no guidance and there is no rational basis, it cannot be constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for an interesting argument. It's an item that hasn't been explored before, and we're pleased that you brought it to our attention for review. So thank you very much. We are going to adjourn and